Brett, as we've been talking about the Supreme Court, obviously it only has 8 members now because, as I've said many times, God has term limits. And one superior jurist in many people's minds, not mine, but many people's minds, thinks that, you know, he was a great guy. The Republicans refused to let the president appoint. So you're riding along with 8 justices. What does that mean?
It means that you do not have a definitive majority in all cases. So in other words, just this past week, we've already seen that vacancy that you referenced affecting the business of the court. The court announced its first deadlock since Justice Scalia's death. Now, I think importantly, it was kind of a low profile dispute, if that can be said of the Supreme Court. It was a case involving the application of gender discrimination protections to spouses of applicants for bank loans, right? So a fairly obscure part of the law for most Americans. But it's really important. What this kind of underscores is the implications of having this vacancy long term. Both the 6th and 8th circuits had rendered decisions on this area of the law, and they disagree with one another. And so, in other words, what is going on right now in the United States is that one interpretation of the law is being applied in a place like Missouri, and another interpretation of the law is being applied in Ohio. In other words, our national law is not being applied uniformly, and the Supreme Court, whose job it is to ensure one uniform interpretation of the law, has not been able to carry out that particular role. And so that's on a very kind of low profile.
But that's very interesting because what most people talk about is the fact that if it's 4-4, you go with the lower court decision. But in this case, there are 2 different sets of lower courts.
Yeah, and the major trigger of the Supreme Court deciding to hear a case is a dispute in the lower courts. So, in other words, that's the major feeder for the Supreme Court. And so you're likely, until there is a deciding vote in this case, in other words, a 9th justice on the court, to have disputes in areas that matter. So this week, for example, the Supreme Court is going to hear yet another challenge to the Affordable Care Act regarding kind of employer-mandated coverage of birth control. And the last time that the court decided that in the Hobby Lobby case, Scalia was part of the 5-member majority that voided such a requirement for family-owned businesses with, I guess, religious objections to provide birth control. So, you know, if in fact that same coalition holds, you're likely to see yet another 4-4. And this goes on in a number of very high-profile and important areas, including environmental regulation. It's possible to see it in affirmative action, and in a host of other places. So, you know, it really does underscore how important it is to have a full contingent of Supreme Court justices on the bench.
It depends. I mean, if you happen to think that the 5-4 decisions on the conservative Republican part have been horrendous all along, you settle very easily for a 4-4 split. So I wanted to question you about that. What happens, Brett Hayes, to the characters on the court, knowing that there isn't going to be the inevitable 5-4 in some of these close decisions? Does the judicial behavior of the jurists change, of the people who are on the court, change knowing what the eventual outcomes will be?
Here's where I think it changes. One, to answer your first question, there's not a lot of there's not a large sample size for us to be able to determine whether it really affects behavior or not. And I think in voting in terms of case outcomes, it's unlikely to. However, where you may see it have an effect is in granting certiorari, where the court is asking to hear cases. And the court may well steer clear of certain cases where they're less clear that they can resolve the dispute until such a point where they know that they can resolve the dispute. And so, you know, the court may very much kind of steer a safer path in the kinds of cases it hears over the next, you know, year until there is a justice to take Scalia's place. But this is important, right, in the sense that it kind of defines what the court's business will be. And so the vacancy has effects, even if, in fact, it's not affecting voting patterns.
When you talk about the ability, I've always thought the pronunciation was certiorari, but maybe I'm wrong, to take cases. You know, they have to vote on whether to take cases or not. Now, the outcome of that decision to either take or not take obviously has a great deal to do with the way in which the law is going to be interpreted by the court, as you suggest. So how dangerous is this for the country?
Well, dangerous is a word
subjective.
I'm not sure I'd go that far, but it does create a lot of uncertainty. I mean, one of the things that the law is supposed to do is to create stability and certainty. And the Supreme Court plays an important part of ensuring that at a national level. And the degree to which there is, the inability to do that because of the 4-4 split suggests that the law is not functioning the way it fully should. Now, that being said, I think the other thing that you're getting at is about the perception of this dispute long term. And one of the things that is so notable is that clearly we've injected kind of naked politics into the nomination and confirmation processes, right? We talk about how this process has become politicized. That, I think, does undermine people's conceptions of rule of law, right? It's very easy then to think that nothing matters in judicial determinations but ideology. And time and again, we see that that's not the case, that ideology is important. In fact, it may be kind of fundamentally important, but it's not all there is. Where there are clear rules of law, those are applied, particularly in lower courts, right? And so that you do create certainty, you do create greater levels of uniformity. And in the absence of that, it creates problems. It creates inefficiencies and it creates uncertainties. And that's what we're hoping to avoid in our legal system.
So let me ask you, we only have a minute, but if Hillary Clinton becomes the president of the United States, would you expect her to reappoint Merrick Garland?
Does she have the Senate?
She does not have the Senate.
Then I think that's a strong possibility. In other words, you have to get somebody through this process. I think actually Republicans on ideology would be fairly supportive of Garland. Even though, by the way, I think sometimes it's a little bit too much has been made that he's a moderate. I'm not really sure. He's
voted. What do you think he is?
I think he is left of center. And I think it's very dangerous to assume the voting patterns that we've seen as a lower court judge will remain as a Supreme Court judge, because rules of precedent are different, right? That, in other words, Supreme Court justices have more discretion as to how they want to decide than lower court judges do. And as a function of that, I my sense of the universe is that Judge Garland is a particularly good candidate in that he appears to be moderate, but he may not be quite as moderate as he appears.
Well, let's put it this way. He's not Scalia. So
right.
It is always wonderful to talk to our friend Brad Hayes, Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College, and more importantly, Scholar in Residence right here at WAMC. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Alan.